Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the Life Wisdom Podcast with your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Bhakti Marg Swami, a prominent member, a leader within the ISKCON movement. It's a pleasure having you on the podcast today.
Thank you, Dr. Raj. Appreciate it so much.
Perhaps a wonderful way to start is to explain to folks what this beautiful name means, Bhakti Marg, and maybe even tell them at some point what a Swami is.
Sure. Let's start with Swami. Swami is basically a title that is in reference to the renounced order of life. It's usually something that's awarded to an individual who's gone through monastic lifestyle and has made it now affirmed. Meaning, like in the latter stage of one's life, it means retirement, like super retired, downscaling, being a bit of a wanderer, and having very few possessions, and moving about in such a way as to inspire people on the spiritual side of life, and to be inspired.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that in your view or in your tradition that the Swami life is analogous to perhaps monastic life in Christian tradition?
Yeah, most definitely so. What you're going to find in our tradition, which is Vedic Hindu lineage background, is that a person who has brahminical inclinations, meaning priestly kind of proclivities, that person usually goes for training for about 20 years. And lives with a guru. I'm talking about in traditional, portfolio. And then we'll learn a lot from that guru. Everything from maybe astrology to, you know, the Vedic texts, astronomy, how to perform ancient rites, sacrifices, how to help people get through with their different rites of passage, marriage, death, you know, as we say, hatch. A match and dispatch, and then also to be perhaps a little bit of a counselor if that is the inclination. So then, one gets married after some time, and then may decide to somewhere between 50-60 to renounce the role and with the consent of family, move about and so on like that. So. We do have that system within our ISKCON, and I was just a little bit of an oddball. I didn't get married. I probably got myself hooked up in my previous life, and I was satisfied, saturated, whatever you want to call it, and completed that notion.
The karmic itch was scratched.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Right. So that Swami. Basically, it is like an ordained title. And, you know, prior to that, I was already a monk, like a celibate monk throughout my life. And but when you become a Swami, it just means that's now it's affirmed you are or confirmed. And this is your role now in society. You don't get implicated into areas of deep administration necessarily, or, you know, into relationships, period, but just lead the very simple life, you know. And then, so that's the meaning of Swami. That's the title. Inference.
Before I dive into Bhakti Marg, these are rich terms from the ancient Indian context, of course. I wish to just touch on something you just said. On this podcast, I ask naive questions so as to tease out some themes for people. Sure. Who may not have backgrounds in religion or Hinduism, but they're living on this earth and they might be looking for some tips on how to do so or what it means to live upon this earth. Now, you mentioned that your Swami path entailed celibacy. Could you explain to us what does brahmacharya or what does celibacy mean to you? In your tradition, and then what does it have to do with life wisdom or the good life? Could you explain that to us?
Sure. Well, celibacy means, I'll give you a parallel word, celebrate. to be celibate means to celebrate, but you celebrate the spiritual circle of life. The development of one's inner self. By nature, we have this what we call Atma, and that's our identity. We're not these bodies, but we are purely spirit. And to cultivate that spirit more, you go through a particular training, and that means that you just don't cultivate the relationship with the opposite sex, at least for a period. And that's for the brahmachari title. And as I mentioned in my case, I've just kept it that way throughout my life. And it means you develop good, strong bonds with your peers, those that you're working with in the ashram together, in the monastery, in terms of study, in terms of various services that are rendered within the ashram or / temple. It means you take a lead in what we call sangha. That means you can organize spiritual events, gatherings, and talks based on the holy texts that we call the shastras. In my particular case, I had a chance to cultivate some culinary skills, and develop that side of myself. I also have an artistic side, so I've actually worked with communities, and I travel the world to big festivals. So again, I'm talking about my own personal experience. And I work with the local youths, and we put together dramas to be staged at big events. And in this way, I'm, utilizing whatever kind of God-given gifts were given to me. Let's say, dovetailing them in the service of the divine. So this is called Yukta Vairagya. It's a term that hails from one of our great teachers in our lineage. He said, real renunciation, real detachment from this world or spiritual cultivation means looking at your assets, your gifts, your skills, and talents, and utilizing them in the service of the world like that. So it's really a kind of, for me, it means, or for a standard brahmachari or monk, a preoccupation in a very holistic kind of lifestyle. And it can involve charity work as well, like food distribution, and definitely has a lot to do with disbursement of wisdom, as well as making available to people's ears the sound, which is sacred, mantras and so on like that. So that immersion in these types of activities, which are very whole and complete, and when I say whole, I mean wholesome, both physically and spiritually, that's what is your engagement, And has been my experience. I became a monk in 1973, so I've been at it for a little while.
And just to clarify for folks listening who may not have quite the background in Indic religions or brahmacharya, this life entails chastity, does it not?
Yeah, absolutely. It's an abstinence of, a relationship with someone on the physical, sexual level. And it just means that you keep yourself occupied in things that nurture the soul as well as the body.
Would you say that these precepts of chastity and the spirit of renunciation at large that you speak about, in your view, is that key for life wisdom or the pursuit of life wisdom? What's the relationship?
Well, as we touched on how it generally works for those who have sort of a strong spiritual inclination. When one is young, one lives within the Gurukul, and then one goes through that celibate period. Then if one has an inclination towards married life and the kind of responsibility, which is usually 99.9% of the time, one is encouraged to fit into that role and to be a responsible householder, as we use the term, to be a good father and husband and so on like that. And so that means you have a full-on experience of celibacy, and then chastity, and then later on, let's say developing that bond and responsibility with the child rearing and trying to comfort one spouse. If one is inclined to slowly reduce those kind of responsibilities, then one may then later on become a sannyas, which means to, in some ways, go back to early student life, like as a brahmachari. So that is, I would say it's a little bit of a different spin or approach to what we hear from some other traditions where it's celibacy all the way through. It's usually that you have that full-on experience in your years of passion, you kind of direct them in a way which is, wholesome, but a spiritual center is preserved. And people will like this. I'd like to quote from the Bhagavad Gita, our main text, where the Supreme Bhagavan Krishna, he says, "I am sex, which is not contrary to Dharma." In other words, he's saying one can enjoy a wholesome family life, but just keep that spiritual center and be, of course, very committed to, one's partner. Like that.
You mentioned the Bhagavad Gita, this great Sanskrit text of classical Hinduism that's so foundational for the ISKCON movement. In your perspective, do you feel that the wisdom from the Bhagavad Gita is something that can be drawn on from beyond the ISKCON or the Hindu context, or do you feel that that wisdom flourishes within the ISKCON or the Hindu context in particular?
Well, I think that the wisdom that is presented by Krishna to his warrior friend Arjun, it's of a universal nature. It is jnanam, period. Jnanam means wisdom and the science of life. We're looking at a scenario where Arjuna was in a situation where he's like a broken man, broken down, depressed, basically, and he just didn't feel up to his responsibilities. And I think that happens to everybody. You wake up one morning and says, "Oh my God, there's so much pressure these days at the office. And I don't know, my son is giving me a hard time. My daughter is pregnant and she's only this many years old, blah, blah, blah." So in modern days. So anyways, Arjuna was going through this kind of like colossal challenge. And Krishna kind of helped him to gain a spiritual perspective on things. First of all, Krishna is saying, "Well, listen, you are meant for this. You are meant and trained for this kind of role of a kshatriya, which is to serve and to protect." And so to kind of squirm out of it, it's quite not organic, or it's not natural for you. So just when they need you now, please, think this over deeply. And then Krishna helped Arjuna to gain the spiritual perspective. Listen, you're worried about the loss of lives, even your own, but we're not these bodies, and ultimately the body will die. So what is the need for, getting highly emotional about things? So let's carry on in the spirit of a fighter, in the sense that, our Atma, our soul, never dies. The body will eventually, And so in the modern day context, COVID can come and grab you and knock you down, bring you down to your knees and then to the ground, so to speak. But it's the soul that persists. And that is the sublime message that comes through in the Gita. That's what gives you a certain kind of bravado, or like an inner strength that helps you to kind of like push on with regular duties and responsibilities until it's time to say goodbye, as the famous song goes, time to say goodbye.
Yes, I can't help but it just so happens that my personal training, my academic training, is in Sanskrit texts, and so narratives, the Puranas, the Bhagavad Gita. I was recently writing an article in the Bhagavad Gita that really comes to mind as you're speaking about what Krishna is doing with Arjuna, and this epithet of Achyuta, the unfallen one, the unfallible one. And Achyuta is trying to help Arjuna to become Achyuta, like, get up. And it's very powerful. I tend to agree with you. This podcast welcomes many perspectives. There's no need to agree. The beauty is in different voices, but I tend to also be inclined to view the great wisdom texts of the world as universal in their what they're hoping to accomplish. And this podcast is trying to understand what we can make sense of, how to make sense of being a human being and living a meaningful life. And so two things come to mind. One is this idea of the pandemic, and perhaps comparable in many ways to being in a war, to being at war. Do you think the Bhagavad Gita or anything from your training offers specific wisdom about dealing with this battle in which we're engaged as a globe?
Well, yes. I mean, it comes clear through Bhagavan Krishna's teachings in the Gita that there are fourfold miseries of life, four prominent challenges. And one is Janma, which is birth, Mrityu, which is death, Jara, old age, and then Vyadi, disease. So this final one, which if you dissect the word dis-ease, you know, we tend to always go for what's easy, but what's imposed on us is dis-ease. And the pandemic that we're going through is a battle, and you know, how to tackle it. Well, there are different approaches, but in the end, doesn't matter how healthy, how much of a superman you are, you will be brought down, you know, by the forces of nature, and then you'll get a chance to, you know, just try it all over again, like almost go from where you left off before through the transmigration of the soul policy. So death will come, and it is a battle. I believe that, not to be highly critical with the way it's all being handled by our authorities, but I would say people's lifestyles need to be more seriously looked at. I think we need a little better training and education, how to be more proactive instead of reactive, where we become such a reactive culture, you know, and living in a lot of fear. But if you kind of like go for the right dietary practices and also a healthier lifestyle, you're liable to be less inclined to become a victim of these kind of circumstances. You know, I mean, nobody's free from being struck, really. But I think a more educational kind of approach to our life would be helpful. And so therefore, Krishna talks about the three energies and how to look at life through the filtering of the three energies or gunas. And so one is sattva guna. So if we live through thoughtfulness and good planning and you know, careful, yeah, basically goodness principles, we're less inclined to fall prey to these kinds of human frailties. So to build up your immunity and so on like that. So I would say that that would be a criticism in our educational system that we have currently. It's the focus is not so much on wholeness. It's let's say a wellness kind of lifestyle, but it's the approach is more like see what you can grasp, see what you can grab in terms of acquisitions, and you will die and that'll be it. So try to simply move in this life, eking out whatever you can for stimulation, and then because you're going to die and it'll be over. So you've got just little chance there, a little room of opportunity, but through the wisdom of the Gita, we understand that, okay, I will perish, but then I would be born again with another chance, a second chance, and an opportunity to, you know, whatever gifts I've gained from prior, whatever wisdom I've achieved, it'll be retained, and I'll be able to, let's say, ride on that wisdom, that increased wisdom. It's almost like now I'm promoted and now I can do better. And I will strive to be as the best as I can as a human being and in the sattva guna and the mode of goodness. So I don't know if I said too much there.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So, well, as I've, I have a podcast called New Books in Indian Religions. It's more of an academic podcast explaining new scholarship to the public. This is more of a an inner life spiritual sort of podcast, I'd say. But the same applies. I always say to interviewees that I always prefer the scenic route.
Okay,
because
good.
There's no agenda but the exchange, the dynamic, organic exchange that's born of the moment. Because that is that is what's real, and people can feel when it's a real conversation versus like an examination or something scripted. And so what comes to mind, I mean, there are a number of things that come to mind, but one thing you touch on is this notion of reincarnation and this notion of the perspective of having one life, living one life, and the implications thereof versus the perspective of rebirth, so crucial to religions of Indic origin. Now, is it fair to say then, or surmise that in your view, that notion of rebirth is key to life wisdom, that's a very important from what I'm gathering?
Well, it is. It is quite something to treasure in terms of, you know, if we're talking about looking at the divine as a loving entity, one who gives one another opportunity should we fail in this life. And many of us are just not going to reach, as we say, perfection in this one life. We're not going to come out clean. We still have a clutter, the little demons to deal with. So it's just the notion that I'm giving another opportunity. And, you know, life is really short. Ever goes like a flash in the pan. So then, you know, being born again into a situation of opportunity, a new door opening for you where you continue on with, you know, carrying with you the compounded, you know, thing of wisdom that you've amassed, and then and carry on from there to reach greater goals. It's really quite a prize in life. And it is important. It is a circle, and it is what we see in this world with the seasonal changes. Everything seems to be quite cyclic. And at the same time, where we find depth in Krishna's teachings is that while there is a cyclic pattern, there's also a linear movement as well. That means that you can pull out of this samsara or this repetition of birth and death, you know, because life is cruel in many ways, as we can see with what some people are going through with the virus. It is cruel, but out of that, going through that suffering, one should be able to, let's say, amass a certain kind of wisdom. You know, like it's like we're like coal, and as pressure is put on, and we'll become a diamond after a while. So through pressure, we shine up, so to speak. You know, we can start to glow. So just that, it's definitely an integral part of our teachings. Is that you're given another chance, another opportunity, and greater hope. I think most faith groups talk about a better life to come. But in our particular tradition, since it's hard to make the grades in this world in terms of fine-tuning your character. Therefore, we're given some opportunities more than once.
You mentioned earlier this Sanskrit word of jnana, or knowledge, or wisdom, or insight, and Krishna giving this great jnana to Arjuna, and thereby really anyone who engages the Bhagavad Gita. This is one path to the divine. There are, of course, different paths to the divine, and perhaps this is a good opportunity for you to comment on the meaning of Bhakti Marg in addition to Swami.
Sure. Well, thank you. And what we understand from the Gita's teachings, which is a compilation of 700 verses, it's actually like a wisdom book, which is in sections. And first we hear about karma yoga, which means to look at your psychophysical nature and see how you can channel that in the most constructive way to contribute to society, to your community. And then once you put out all that, like say blood, sweat, and tears, or muscle power, whatever you want to call it, through karma yoga, then you can cultivate a little bit more of the jnana yoga, which means to, you know, to discern a little difference between what is matter and what is spirit, what is right and what is wrong. I mean, the jnana yoga, or I guess you say jnana, little different pronunciation. It should always be there right from the beginning, as soon as you learn, age 5+. But finally, this wisdom or jnana yoga should translate or transform into bhakti. And bhakti means devotion, where, basically you cultivate the richness in life through loving exchanges with the divine, with the creator. And so this is the ultimate objective in the Gita's teachings. I'll give you a Sanskrit verse to support what I'm saying. Yogi nam api sarvesham madgatin antaratmanam shradhavan bhajate yomang same yuktatamo mataha. So that of all the yogic paths, one should ultimately come to the stage of love. You know, as the saying goes, all you need is love. So love means with the divine, with the creator, with the creation, and with the creatures. You know, it's that kind of triangle that we have to touch, you know, and hit all those points. Not just that I have love for God, for the divine, and I don't have much care for the human race, or I have no, empathy towards, issues with nature or ecological sensitivities. I should be able to have a profound love for all. And that's what bhakti hopes to do. So bhakti means devotion, and marg means path. So that's the name that was given to me. I can't say that I am a devotional path, but I am on the devotional path. And I have sort of gained a little bit of a reputation for being a walker doing devotion on the path. I have walked across Canada 4 times and then US once, and I've done a few other countries like Israel and Ireland and a few little more tropical places, and for the purpose of, not because it matches up to my name's definition, but that came later. I first started walking, and then I realized, oh, my guru gave me this name because he knew I was going to do some bhakti devotion on the path. So I think it was quite of a mystical revelation that came one day on the first walk I did across Canada. Mm. And so that's also a very big part of our culture, is to roam and meet people and get connected to the elements.
Well, it's so many threads there. The first I'll ask you is, you mentioned in passing your guru who initiated you and gave you this name. Who was that?
His name is Bhaktivedanta Swami, also known to us as Prabhupada. He's the founder Acharya of the Hare Krishna movement. He was born in the late 19th century and in Kolkata, and he came to America in 1965, and which was a very unique time in the history of North America, counterculture, and he was a draw. He
was they were ready draw. For him. Yeah. Krishna primed the pump.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. And so he started in New York, and there was New York was a very interesting place, a real hotbed for introspective people. And you know, there was you were at the height of the Vietnam War, where people were, Americans especially, were wondering, why are we engaged in this senseless war? What does it have? What relevance does it have to us? And of course, he had 1967. He was there right at the right time when the Summer of Love, and he sort of redefined what is love, like on a more top-notch notion. And a lot was happening at that time, you know. Like I was born and raised near Detroit on the Canadian side. And Detroit was going through, it was not the Summer of Love, it was a summer of contempt, if anything. And Black Day in July was a popular song by Gordon Lightfoot at that time. And you stand on the Windsor side and you hear all the bombs and the fire, you know, the guns going off and the army coming in. It was a really turbulent time for us. And it was a time for introspection. Young people were looking for, what's my meaning? What am I supposed to be doing here?
And speaking of the passing of decades, what wisdom has been unfurled in your mind, heart now? What do you know now, or perhaps you wish you knew before? What has occurred to you over this time?
Well, I would say when I first came to participate in the monastic life as a Hare Krishna monk, I was so impressed with some of the bullet point, or what you might call sutras, messages that would stick with you, that allowed you, that probed a little bit into your little, whatever little brain substance you have. So like things like Aham Brahmasmi, which means I'm spirit, I'm not this body. Because we were living, and I was living in a world trying to think, you're the body and that's everything. You know, you enjoy it, you go for the stimuli. But, you know, just getting this foundational words of wisdom that I am spirit, not this body, was just something that I've been holding on to all this time. And as you cultivate your God consciousness, your higher consciousness, you start to actually feel it. You know, of course, you have to address your little demons within. And you have to come, you know, start to act more like a spirit and think like a spirit instead of a physical being, you know, and less into misjudgment, but rather into probing deeper and see every living entity is a spirit. So, you know, over the years, you start to not just look at it theoretically or appreciate it that in that way, in an analytical way, but you start to actually feel it. So there's another verse in the Gita where Krishna says, Vidyavidaya sambhane brahmane kavahaschini shuni chaiva shwapakecha pandita samadarshina, which means that a real pundit or a real wise individual is one who can see that there's spirit, there's life force in all existences. And that in the body of a dog, or even a man who eats a dog, which is not considered to be super high class, or like a Brahmin, you know, a person who's like of the priestly order, or a cow or an elephant. These are the five categories that are listed. It could have been, you know, millions, but for more simplicity's sake, Krishna gives those examples that all these beings are, you know, have equanimity. About them, they're all spirits, even though they're in different bodies. So if we can see that, grab that sense of oneness, which is what you were supposed to cultivate in time, then this is what little I have gained, you know, by like in small morsels. Trying to get big bundles.
So clearly, if I'm hearing you correctly, wisdom or the good life or life well lived ultimately has to do with an expansion of consciousness, a spiritualization, if you will, a weaning off of the body and pleasures of the flesh, and are growing into a larger awareness of consciousness and being. That much, I think, is palpable. Here's a question I have for you. Do you feel that that process, that spiritualization, that cultivation of wisdom of which you speak, is it necessarily tied to the teachings of Krishna?
Oh, yes. You know, our whole life is immersed in the teachings of Krishna, because for us, our primary texts that we indulge in is Bhagavad Gita, which is spoken by him. And we have the Bhagavad Purana, which is spoken about him, where it's much more voluminous than Bhagavad Gita itself. And then we have other texts along the bhakti lineage, which is written by individuals inspired in Krishna consciousness, the Shat Goswamis of Vrindavan from like 500 years ago, like when India was going through an incredible kind of like bhakti renaissance with saints like Mirabai and Guru Nanak and Surdas, and then of course there was Sri Chaitanya. These were like incredible luminaries that kind of put bhakti on the map, which of course it was always there to some degree, but instead of an underground or undercurrent, they brought it more to the fore, you know. And what our guru Swami Prabhupada did was he translated many of these books, and such as Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, and the English translation is Nectar of Devotion, and teachings of Sri Chaitanya and so on like that. All geared towards devotion, you know, which is, let's say, more solidly amplified through mantra meditation and through kirtan, through chanting, singing, playing instruments, and, you know, basically having a spiritual party. Let's put it like that. That's one nice thing, you know, everybody loves to party. And when our guru came from India, he said, here's a redefinition of party, okay? You don't need the hallucinogenics. You don't need this, that. Maybe you can even put sex to the side and let's just have some fun. Here, the drums will beat. They'll get you gyrating. They'll, we'll have some food on the side. You sing, you dance, you in abandonment, you could say. So it's all very wholesome. And you keep doing that till you get tired and you have a good sleep. Kind of like that. And you meet people, make friends. And that's the whole idea about kirtan, which is so popular
now. So how often do you party these days?
Well, with the pandemic, I'll be honest with you. I'm in isolation. I've got two more days to go. So I have a mild case of COVID. So I have not been able to party in the normal sense. But other than that, yes, during this last year, it's not as it has been, where we can go in the public, go in a park and do some nice things, or be in a temple and invite everybody. So it's been another redefinition, you know. So I was spending a little more time on reading and writing, and I like to do poetry. So it's making adjustments. That's what it is. And I think that's at the core of the bhakti culture, to be ready to bend, to adjust. You can never change the basic principles. They will always be what they are. You can't alter them, but you can adjust the presentation. And there's many different ways to serve, as it were. And as long as it's done with love and devotion, as Krishna states in the Gita, offer to me with love and devotion a leaf, flower, fruit, or water, and I will very much accept it. So Krishna is not demanding love. He's just saying, suggesting love. And that's what bhakti is. He, at the end of the Gita, when he's having that dialogue with Arjuna, he says, it's really up to you. what you want to do. I'm just telling you what the bhakti program is and take it or leave it. But Krishna knew Arjuna well enough, being her friend, so I know which one you're going to choose. I know which what route you're going to go on. So there wasn't really a choice in the matter, I guess you could say.
Is there any thought? Is there, how do I ask this? Do you ever make sense of the pandemic through your path? Or how do you make sense of the pandemic?
Well, the way we look at it is that there's always going to be some pandemic. I remember in the 69, we took shots for polio. And I still have the document in my files. And it's just, it always keeps these things coming in waves. It was prior to that, it was SARS, and it was, other forms of this. And it just keeps coming. It seems to be an intrusion, but it is one of those waves, like standing at the edge of the ocean, and waves will come, you know? And so how you deal with it is really the key factor behind, being able to cope or not cope. So I pandemic or not, I think like life itself is a big pandemic, death itself. And if we don't get stricken with COVID-19, it's going to be a flu, it's going to be cancer, it's going to be like all the other things that we sort of put to the side, forgotten about. You know, they were always there. And if we look at many people die from drinking every year, from liquor, and in the millions, globally. So why don't we look at that a little deeper? Maybe we should, tone down in that area, or whether it's just eating certain kind of foods that are unholy, and there's so many things that cause disruption physically and psychologically. Right now, we've decided we're going to hone in on one particular virus, but there's hundreds and millions of thousands floating around into the atmosphere. And I think that the best thing we can do is to lead as clean a life as possible, and what we call a sattvic life, living more for the moment, as opposed to living in that mode of passion, which is called rajaguna. And that is your head too much into the future. And then a lot of people say what we call living in the mode of ignorance, technically in Sanskrit it's called tamagun, means to live too much in the past and to be caught up in self-pity and so on like that. So better to live in the present and try to guard yourself and do the best you can.
So live in the present, and all you need is love. Here are our words of wisdom.
Absolutely. And I think one big thing too is to grab a hold of your true identity. There's so much confusion today in terms of, sexual orientation and which gender am I really? I think I'll switch from this to that. And, but ultimately, we're not these bodies. Again, I go back to that point. Grab a hold of your true identity. Get off the identity crisis and embrace this concept. I am a spirit which persists life after life. I am not this body. So once you grab a hold of your true identity, then it comes much easier. What should I now do with myself? That would be the natural question to follow. That would be subsequent to now gaining my understanding of who I really am. What will I do? Well, if I'm a spirit and not this body, maybe I should be doing spiritual things. This makes it, clears the road, it's like taking the snow plow through and being able to tread that path a lot easier, this human path.
So why then would you say there are relatively few human beings who are in that mindset or consciousness or on that path of spiritualizing?
I do believe that a lot of people ponder these things, what you and I are talking about, when they get on in their maturity. I do believe it happens. It's natural. When you don't have that oomph, the sex drive isn't there. The hormones don't explode much anymore. And there's more aches and pains. But when you are brighter on another level, the lower body parts are not as active, animated, and the animation is a little bit more here because of the experience. So I believe that is strong in our seniors, and that's why they need to be the most revered. And I would say, you know, pop culture that we live in, and everyone's influenced by, whether Hollywood or Bollywood, it doesn't promote long-term effects. It's into short-term, because it's quite all hooked up to consumerism, you know, buy something now, get this, you know, get things, stuff. And instead of downscale, less is more, you know, that's not the message. I wish rappers could talk about that and live it too. Then it might influence people in a more favorable direction.
Is there anything else that you wanted to share?
Well, one thing I'd like to say is I had a good time talking with you, and Krishna says, I am time, like God is equated with time. So I'm afraid I will have to go, and I have to respect that aspect of the creator, that I am time. But I would just like to say I enjoyed this very much, and I'd like to encourage people simply to value simplicity as opposed to complexity, and gain and grab a hold of your identity more so as a spirit as opposed to the absorption in the physical covering. You know, what's more important is you and not your shirt or your dress. It's you are more important. You're more valued, because it's you that's going to persist.
Well, thank you for the conversation today.
Thank you. Appreciate it so much.
So for those of you listening, those words of wisdom were shared by by Bhakti Marg Swami of the ISKCON movement, with a great deal of food for thought in terms of how to live this thing we called human life. Until next time, stay safe, stay well, and keep contemplating what it means to be walking in wisdom.